Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And as I always say, it's all about full compliance with the Constitution. That if we're serious about really wanting to see the government that was handed to us, that was basically inspired by the divine hand of providence and put down into a framework in our Constitution by our framers, then the only way to get there is to start electing and supporting constitutional compliance candidates and having our public servants be champions of the Constitution, period. That's it, folks. In other words, we need people to, you know, throw water on their back when they're not looking. Maybe we can grow a spine in some of these folks because they need to start standing up. Now, that's why we have a champion in Missouri, Jerry Wistrand, who is literally running a campaign, and he could use help in covering his costs. You know, let's overwhelm the guy. Let's make it so that he can't say, well, I wish I would have had more support. I could have done, I think I could have done much better. Let's not give the guy, I'll just say the door of an excuse. Folks, let's help this guy, give him all the money he needs, give him all the support he needs, call him. He's available. I'd love to hear him say, hey, GR, you know, stop it. I'm getting too much money, and I'm getting too many people calling, offering help. And even though I have all this campaign support and everything else, just stop. That's a problem I'd like to see. So until I hear him say that, I'm going to just keep on trying to remember on a daily basis, if you want to be involved in actually trying to help, here you go. We need to support candidates, your candidates, candidates across the nation. And right now, the one candidate that we know that signed a pledge, I mean, shoot, in Wyoming, there's some pretty decent people, but I won't support them. Decent people. I don't care. Decent doesn't give us constitutional compliance. Decent people, you know, they all go in decent, and they may still be in decent, but they still are acting, and they're only doing political theatrics because they're serving themselves. So, With that, let me get back to, because we kind of ended the show yesterday on a note, and i.e. the question of what do we do about the Senate and all of this. And I didn't feel like it really went its full volition because there just wasn't enough time. And so what I want to do is give Sean some time, because I believe when you're looking at it, we have to start somewhere, and we have to have people start doing the right thing. And I believe that, I'll just say this, that I believe the windows and doors of heaven are waiting for us to actually act in faith, do the right things. And I am confident that we will be blessed if we do those things. But that being said, let me, you know, get back to Sean, because we kind of left the conversation with my stating that we need to start enforcing at the state level, county level, what have you. So what's your thoughts on this? Because I know you agree that we have to start, you know, enforcing the Constitution. We've got a problem with the courts and all of this. So go ahead.
Oh, yeah. And I totally agree as well. And looking at the text of it, and it's always bewildered me since I actually found this out, and it was one of those red pill moments where the Senate is supposed to be representing the legislatures of the states, and it was changed in the 17th Amendment, but it doesn't mention the legislatures whatsoever.
Right. Right, because
I don't understand how a state legislature would allow this to happen. Three-fourths of the states had to approve this, had to ratify this amendment, and how was it that they just said, okay, we're going to hand our power over, and yeah, no problem.
Okay.
When that was one of the main concerns in the convention, and I agree with you, throughout the whole convention, everyone who was for the Constitution, and when they talked about it, even people who were adversaries agreed that in this paradigm, the legislature should select the senators and the people elected the representatives. That was the whole point of the separation. So how did it get to where the states just said, yeah, okay, we're going to hand this over and not even argue about the language of the amendment? Because if you read the Constitution and then you read the amendment, the 17th Amendment, you're more than likely going to come away with the idea that the legislatures have nothing to do with the Senate or having suffrage or any of that. You would have to dig down into the ratification debates and read that. And that was intended, but I don't understand why it wasn't put in and why it was allowed to happen. You've talked to several state representatives and people at different levels. What do they have to say about it when you bring it up to them?
So I think that most of them, because I've only talked to a few, and so I don't think that people act like gate guards. As a matter of fact, let's go to the 16th and 17th Amendment first. Let me because there's one thing I want to answer that question, but I want to give you some information. There's a guy by the name of, I believe it's Bill Bennett, that if you look at the 16th Amendment and the 17th Amendment, they're both highlighted that he believed that those amendments were not passed unconstitutionally. Now, I think it might have been the 17th Amendment and or the 16th, one of the two, that this happened in Oregon on one of these two amendments, that the amendment came out and you realize that state legislatures meet at the beginning of the year. So the amendment came out after the legislative session, but it was an election year. And the people that were in office were going to actually pass the amendment. There were plenty of people in Oregon, I forget which one, so it's the 16th or 17th, you have to do the research on it because it's been a long time since I read this. And so it's out there in the gray matter, you know, falling off the cliff, if that makes sense. But anyway, but I do remember some of the details on this, that there was a good effort in the Oregon state election campaign of people actually running to say, I will not vote to pass that. We will reject that amendment, whether it was the 16th or 17th. And those people actually won their elections, and everybody realized that if these people were seated, then they would reject the amendment. So there was this collusion and secrecy that those people were not sworn in. This was like, and new people coming in, they don't realize, hey, when am I going to get sworn in? So they said, well, we'll swear you in when the session begins. And it didn't bring any attention or it didn't, you know, people didn't, what? I should be sworn in before the session so I can start working. They didn't put necessarily two and two together. At least I didn't think it created this huge suspicion, because what ended up happening was when the session began, all of the old incumbents who were actually voted out showed up and they did a special session vote because the Speaker of the House at that point in time, and I think they did it of the, you know, both sides, both of them did this, where they worked together in ratifying. They said, this amendment came in while we were in office, and so we never had a chance to convene because our session was over, so we're going to do our job, and then we're going to end that session. And that was this game they played. And they voted to ratify it. They sent it off as the legislature off, and it was accepted. Bill Bennett highlighted that. And whether, like I said, these are the shenanigans that were being played back when Wilson was in office. And Wilson did other shenanigans, like states that supposedly, you know, debated it. They never did or what have you. And it was always this, you know, well, these states, you know, all of these states had ratified it. And nobody was questioning it, because it's not like they had CNN, MSNBC, and the rest of the, you know, puppets out there like Baghdad Bob. Don't worry, everything's okay, kind of stuff, you know, giving misinformation. So the whole America was sleeping with those two amendments. I don't think at that point in time anybody really cared what was going on in D.C. or these amendments, unfortunately. So the real question is, are these amendments legitimately passed? And you're right. Why would they actually vote for it? So I'm not sure that it was legitimately passed. That's one of the things that actually needs to be done, because that's the whole part of Republic Review. When you finally get there, you'll actually have to audit every state. Every state will actually have to go through and make sure that they legitimately, like the original 13th Amendment, did they legitimately ratify? If they don't have their records or what have you, then it becomes a suspect. As far as why and how would people do that, I look at the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions going out to the states at that point in time. And all of the rest of the states, basically because they were Federalists and they liked the Federalist move of taking political control to protect their seats and to protect their control, they actually, you know, attack Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, or I should say Kentucky, Virginia, and how dare you, you know, do this? This is an insurgency. This is legitimate. The courts, I mean, if you remember how, even at that point in time, how did the state legislatures go so far off? I understand what you're saying. It's hard to fathom. But history has proven that when people become corrupted, or when an ideology is, you know, the ends justify the means, they've got to do this. And it doesn't matter how it looks, you know, they know that they're probably going to stay in office because nobody's holding them accountable. Things won't start changing until we do that. But to find out whether they should have done that and to get to the truth, we have the truth on our side. We have the truth on our side. And so I can't answer why or how they do that. But I do know, and I gave you that Oregon case, that they had some pretty nefarious actions and games that they played to try to get these bad amendments across the end zone, across the touchdown line. So,
yeah, just in a cursory search, I'm seeing that there was a lot of corruption in the Senate, and that the state legislators were being bribed to appoint people as senators. And they decided that it would be better if the people elected them, because that would lessen the corruption.
But again, it was just a change of the appointment, not a change of their responsibilities. Right. And so,
but when you change who elects the official, change who controls the official. How can the people elect somebody and the state legislatures still have control over them? Wouldn't that be going against the people's
vote? So that's interesting.
Disenfranchising the people or the state if the legislator, if they recall them for whatever reason.
Let me ask you this. All things being what they are, if there's no entry in the Constitution protecting that specific suffrage, then you're absolutely right. It becomes this lost paradigm. I mean, only somebody that's really the wonk that has gone and, you know, swam through these books and these records to say, look, this is what it's supposed to be. And now we've got this little technicality that we're, you know, clinging on to. But how divine is it if it's actually engraved, embossed in the Constitution, that this suffrage cannot be taken without their consent?
Right. But I think it comes down to the definition of suffrage. If this state is considered the amalgamation of people within those borders, then the state didn't lose their suffrage.
Well, so
they still
it doesn't matter. So I think the suffrage means the same thing. I think suffrage means the same thing. I think what you're struggling at is states. What does states mean? Do states mean the legislature? Does it mean the people? You know, what does that mean, states? And again, this is where to understand what states mean and states' rights, state sovereignty. It's not the states of the people. If we're Republican in form, then there is this Republican government that was created, and that government had suffrage in the Senate because the people had theirs. And like I said, the Constitutional Convention and those notes clarify that ad nauseum.
Why? No, I understand that, okay. But once they changed it with the 17th Amendment, doesn't that change?
No.
I'm trying to think of an analogy where if you had access to a certain thing and then you changed the rules to where you didn't have the access, it was given to somebody else, then it was taken away from you.
See, my point is because the language wasn't there, a lot of people didn't realize, and I just think, I have no idea, you know, how this misinformation campaign was played out, because I didn't live back in those days. And all I know is evil.
It was, like you said, it was a progressive ruse.
Yes.
And they used the corruption that was
going on
in certain states.
Yes, absolutely.
To embellish it.
So this, you know, this kind of goes down this other, you know, because I get this from other people that, you know, I'm asserting that the states have this sovereignty. And these people say, well, you know, that's not so. And I go, well, let me ask you this. If I convince 27 states that they do, and I convince these 27 states to do these very specific things that Madison and Jefferson laid on the table, then are you going to tell me that they won't be successful?
Oh, absolutely not.
That's
and the
right.
The thing is, like you said, it's in the Constitution. All it would take would be to repeal the 17th Amendment.
Right. And so people, they just try to suppress the argument by obviating, and sometimes they'll just do the ad hominem attack. They come at you in different ways, but they can't prove you wrong. And when you shine the light on truth, the first thing they want to do is cover the truth up by saying, oh, that's your interpretation. It doesn't mean that. The courts have already ruled on that, blah, 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 blah. Because now we have all sorts of good counter. Well, the courts can't rule on that. Courts can't redefine. Courts have no legislative authority, blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, there are all these counters. And when it goes down to the ultimate outcome, when the states assert their authority, they will succeed. There's nothing the federal government can do when all of a sudden we have 27, 28, 30 states. We don't need 34. We just need a good, decent majority, just over the majority to where we have those states controlling that many people in the House of Representatives. We only need 26 just to have control over the Senate. Now we have this confusion of 26 states with, you know, some of them may have Democratic senators. That's why these 26 states, before they get to that 26 states, they're going to make sure that every single one of their senators is giving them their suffrage, that these red states will no longer have this problem, that any Democrats that are representing them, they'll start pulling them back. And they'll actually ensure that their names won't go on the ballot. They will make sure that those people do not get reelected. Some of the things that actually states are really going to have to start creating laws to protect themselves from money, because this money that is being, you know, the courts seem to be really opening doors and windows for corporate money and international money to come into our elections. And so states need, and the state legislatures have to create these laws that say any money coming across our state line to come into our elections is election interference. It's foreign interference, and we will basically put charges on any state, any individual, any nation for trying to interfere in our elections, any person, which means technically, if Trump stands up and says, this is the guy you want, this is the guy I like, whatever, then those types of endorsements would be considered illegal because that's meddling. Now, if somebody was saying, hey, what do you think about the governor race in this particular state? then the only way that I would feel safe in commenting if they have these laws is to say, well, have they been tested on their knowledge of the Constitution? Who scored best? Because whoever scored best is who I will endorse. And boom. Now I've actually shifted it away from this beauty contest to say we should have the best and brightest that understands the responsibility, their legal responsibility to the Constitution, so that we can hold them accountable to it. Now, you see how that just shifts everything?
Yes, sir.
You might be surprised at the people who are on your side on this issue. Just from what I've found, Ted Cruz, Mike Lee, Scalia, Mike Huckabee, and Mark Levin all say the same thing that you say.
Okay. Now, so I'm not surprised. I mean, there's lots of things that we'll agree with. It's just that some of the things, I think Mark Levin is still a hard supporter. He wrote a book called Liberty Amendments. And so if you wrote and you were the catalyst in creating an amendment, that is a mark in history that your name will go down with, you know, that notoriety. I mean, boom. You this is the guy. Renowned, I should say, not notoriety, but you would be renowned for having that positive effect of creating that amendment. It's kind of like, you know, marking, urinating on something, you put your mark on it. There you go. That's your mark. And so, you know, he's all for, you know, that's his outcome. I mean, I think that a lot of times you'll find that most people that really understand the Constitution, I think that there are some that really understand politically that they can't go down certain roads. You know, like this militia thing, that's really a dangerous road to go down for them. And it challenges a lot. It really shifts everything. It transforms America from being a self-serving capitalist nation, actually not a capitalist mercantile nation that's being controlled by government, into truly a free market land of liberty, where now we're actually in control of what laws we're enforcing and so forth. That's a huge shift. That's a huge shift. I mean, America has so much potential that if we go down this path and we're successful in doing this, and I know the divine hand of providence, I know the windows of heaven, I know our Creator would bless us and give us these blessings if we were doing these things. I would say that would probably change government on the face of this earth for a millennia, if not more, because it would take probably 1,000 years, if not longer, to slowly abandon, you know, these principles, because it would literally shift our culture, and people would, all these bad ways and all these bad things would be, you know, well taught in history. I mean, the biggest mistakes advanced societies make is they don't provide the accuracy of, you know, the consequences of these types of other paradigms. You know, what ends up happening is people start editorializing, glossing over. These are the revisionists that start, you know, changing that, and they do that to really undermine. So this is why there's the very elite in education in America that had this damaging effect to basically derail us. And that was back in the 1880s when that happened. It was when the Fabian Society came to America and infiltrated our education system.
What's the saying? History is written by the winners. Apparently they won.
Oh, yeah. Well, but see, they didn't.
No, they didn't win. It's not total victory, but they won that battle. And now we're trying to regroup.
Yeah, so let me just say this. You know what? I'm going to say this when we come back, because history was written by the winners. It's just that people changed all of what we refer to as our history over time. And so when we come back, I'll help kind of clarify that, because it's not that we shouldn't be. I'm going to run out of time. I'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
So the adage is, to the victors go the spoils. I remember I wrote this in my book, and I know a lot of other people have stated this, and I think it's just kind of common to be asserted. To the victors go the pen. To the victors go the recording of the record. The beautiful thing about our history, and history that is, you know, hundreds of years away, that when we look back, our framers actually documented all these conversations. And there's this biblical term, and I think it is either Isaiah or Ezekiel, where it is talked about where we will start learning the truth from the dust, our forefathers, the prophets and our forefathers will speak to us from the dust, from these records, that these hidden records. But see, in our history, they're not hidden. They're just so voluminous and they're just so daunting that people just say, well, give me the cliff notes. And that is where it began. So as I have looked, because I've always been a lover of taking history, as I have watched history classes, courses, and participated and taken, it took me a long time to realize we weren't reading the documents. We were reading editorials from somebody that supposedly we trust. This goes to prove how you can't trust anybody with your children. You can't, because they can say anything and everything. I mean, it's nice that you have somebody with good character, good integrity. It's nice when you find those types of things. But to just have blind trust that you're putting your child into a classroom or into an environment where an adult or somebody else could say things that would create an opening in your children's mind to start accepting lies, deceit, and what have you, misinformation. And so I believe that when we see that the history has been rewritten, it's not the actual history. It is the fact that we accept history because we as a people, and I think this goes all the way back, it transcends all societies. Nobody's ever taken the time to read all their own history. They always just, well, what did it say? And for the most part, they start off with giving you 90% of it and, omitting 10%. And over time, it starts drifting more and more to be actual fabrication, to where now, white people are oppressive and white people are racist or what have you. When we look at things like America, it's all stacked in favor of the white person. I ask you, go to any country, migrate to any country, Japan, any nation in Africa. I don't care where you go. If it's a different culture, different race, then guess what? That nation has stacked, and it's got all of its lots in the favor of that nation, the people that live there. We're not doing anything unusual here that you have to come here and you have to earn your own way. But at least here you can earn your own way. In China or in Japan and many of these other highly controlled, highly regulated nations, good luck. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So, go ahead.
And I think part of the problem is that the people that are being affected by this propaganda and are buying into it have no frame of reference.
Yeah.
All they know is what they're being told. You know, and the more experienced and the more worldly and studied you get about things, then you understand. And another thing is, like on the illegal immigration, if our country is so racist and so horrible and such a white supremacist tyranny, why are all these people risking life and limb and legal peril to come here? What is it about it? Is it just because, I mean, magnetism? I mean, I don't get it. It's just ridiculous. And it's like a lot of things that we talk about in back in the day, talking out of both sides of your mouth. You're saying, oh, you're coming to America to make a better life, but we're all racist and horrible people. How do those two even equate? It's just ridiculous.
So the people that are coming here today are coming here for a handout. If you come here, we will give you a home. We will give you money. We'll help you survive, and you don't have to do anything. As a matter of fact, in certain states, like the state of Washington, all illegals have precedence and have guaranteed health care. The actual people that live here are fighting to have even some kind of their health needs taken care of.
It's so, like when they give away something for free.
Yes, absolutely.
I've seen that before, the man on the street where they go up and they ask the people in the line. They're in the line, 1,000 people long, and they're like, what are you waiting for? I don't know, but it's free. So yeah, they go get in line.
Yeah, I remember when they disclosed the Obama phones. I'm going to get an Obama phone because these are free phones from the federal government back in the Obama phone days. But
Biden was giving out crack pipes.
Yes, so I think that many cities were doing that too.
See how it progresses?
Yeah, absolutely. Bad ideas always grow legs. Good ideas, because we have so much corruption and so many evil people, it's not that we have the majority of people in America are evil. It's the majority of the people, and I kind of see it as this key brotherhood, that the only people that are allowed into the spaces, like you said, you know, who's going to become president, what have you, is those people who are going to be doing their bidding. In other words, we don't have these outliers. Everybody that's going into office, everybody that's becoming a corporate leader, they have to have already been compromised. And they are going to do what they're supposed to do to keep us all going down the right path, the same path. I don't think America is filled with evil people. I think that the people that have pursued the seats of power to come to the trough of power, they have been corrupted on their way there so that they can be controlled. It's one of the things I've learned and realized is that one of the first things that they do for congressmen or what have you is they take you out and get you drunk. And next thing you know, they've got pictures of you with and blah, 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 blah. And next thing you know, you're voting and doing things that your constituents are going, what the heck's going on? And so what they actually do is they try to make it so that it's not, they control you and they make sure you give them the key things that they need. But they do give you a little protection because they need to keep you there, because the next guy that they try to corrupt, they may not be able to corrupt, may not go out to the party with them. Because at every point along the way until you've opened yourself to the corruption, you can always turn away. And so that's a gamble and a risk that they take. So they would much rather keep the person in their control. And I think that when Trump took office, I'll just say this, that when we looked at those 40-some-odd Republicans that decided not to run again, that begged more that there was probably corruption, that they were going to have to do deeds and get involved in things. They said, you know what, I am not pursuing re-election, because didn't want to actually be, you know, become that obvious compromised person. And walking away from it, kind of, it doesn't end it. It doesn't wipe it out, but it just makes it, it's, you now control the suppression of it, because as long as you stay out of the public forum, it's buried. But they have the pictures, boy. They have those pictures. You know what I mean?
Yes, sir. Have you seen Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven?
Yeah.
When he walks in the bar and tells them, any man don't want to die, better head on out the back. Kind of the same situation.
Uh-huh.
Any man that don't want to be taken down, better head on out the back.
We could talk all day about these things, but what we want, what I need to do is we need to get back to the Pennsylvania debates, because we kind of got a few things we still need to cover before we dive into the next debates. And I think at this point in time, let me see, you just finished the second, right? And actually...
Third.
The third. So the fourth is going into the elections. So let's go ahead and do the fourth and cover the elections as well. Go ahead.
Fourth, quote, that the Congress may by law deprive the electors of a fair choice of their representatives by fixing improper times, places, and modes of election, end quote. Every House of Representatives are of necessity to be the judges of the elections, returns, and qualifications of its own members. It is therefore their province, as well as duty, to see that they are fairly chosen and are the legal members for this purpose. It is proper that they should have it in their power to provide that the time, places, and manner of election should be such as to ensure free and fair elections.
So that right there is pretty prophetic, isn't it?
Oh, there's all kinds of prophecy in there.
That's yeah. Okay, keep going.
Annual Congresses are expressly secured. They have only a power given to them to take care that the elections shall be at convenient and suitable times and places and conducted in a proper manner. And I cannot discover why we may not entrust these particulars to the representatives of the United States, which is much with as much safety as to those of the individual states. In some states, the electors vote viva voce, and others by ballot.
Hold on here. Hold on here. What is viva voce?
By voice.
By voice. Okay, so hold on here. What does that mean? By voice. I know we get that, but what does that mean to our elections today? Can you vote by voice today? When we go into the next election in 2026, the general election, it's folks, I'm highlighting this big time because this is really, really important. By voice, do you really think this concept of secret ballots is constitutional?
No.
You see my point? This is how the progressives started. Hey, we have a right to a secret ballot. We have a right to not let anybody know how we're voting. And the reality is, the more you don't know, the more they can play with the numbers and the outcomes, the more that they can actually, you know, get away with actually voting for people and voting for things that are absolutely evil, to where say, you don't belong here. We do not agree with any of your positions. Secret ballots do not protect the innocent and those people who are, you know, lovers of liberty and so forth. It is the people that are trying to undermine liberty that try to convince you that ballots have to be secret. And I want to prove to you, right here it says, in some states the electors vote via voice, that it's right out there. Nine times out of ten, it was very common that when you voted in the elections of the 1796, when they were voting for the president to replace, you know, George Washington, guess what? Almost all of the states did those elections via VOCA because they didn't have the money. The counties didn't have the money to print it out. The sheriff had to do it. And so they would appoint the place and time. The time was in your county at this, you know, and it would be posted. However, that you would need to be there during a certain time, that the sheriff would conduct the election. And so he would go around the town hall by either alphabetically or go around this roster and say, how do you vote? Who do you vote for president? And actually, it's who do you vote for elector? And you would provide a name. They don't put everybody's name on there. They just put who got the vote. And then based on who got the vote in that county, you know, this person won to be the elector. Because in those cases, the counties themselves were practically the legislative districts, or the congressional districts, I should say. But nevertheless, the whole point is this idea of the way we're doing, and this legal requirement that a ballot is to be secret is not constitutional. That the fact that the federal government has created a law to protect the how a person is voted is not something enumerated. They don't have the authority, in other words, to create that kind of law. Remember, laws have to be in pursuant of. You see how this has all happened and where we are today. We have to start actually using the truth, because now we shine light on this and say, you know what? We need to go back to Via Voca. Let's save the money and let's not print paper. Everybody will know at the end of that election, the sheriff will dictate who's just won. We'll all know. And they'll report the winners and that's it. What do you think about that? This is. I knew it was
in agreement with it.
I knew this was in the ratification debate. So just that every year I forget to look for it, and when you said it this time, boom, it just jumped out. There it is, folks. We have hardcore evidence. They've documented that this concept of secret ballots is cockamamie, that it's not a constitutional right, never was. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No problem. It is said, quote, that the powers of Congress under this Constitution are too large, particularly in laying internal taxes and excises, because they may lay excessive taxes and leave nothing for the support of the state governments. End quote. Sir, no doubt, but you will discover on consideration the necessity of extending these powers to the government of the Union. If they have to borrow money, they are certainly bound in honor and conscience to pay the interest until they pay the principal, as well to the foreign as to the domestic creditor. It therefore becomes our duty to put it in their power to be honest. At present, sir, this is not the case. As experience has fully shown, Congress has solicited and required several states to make provision for these purposes. Has one state paid its quota? I believe not one of them. And what has been the result? Foreigners have been compelled to advance money to enable us to pay the interest due them on what they furnished to Congress during the late war. I trust we have had experience enough to convince us that Congress ought no longer to depend upon the force of requisition. I heard it urged that Congress ought not to be authorized to collect taxes until a state had refused to comply with this requisition. Let us examine his position. The engagements entered into by the general government render it necessary that a certain sum shall be paid in 1 year. Notwithstanding this, they must not have power to collect it until the year expires, and then it is too late. Or is it expected that Congress will borrow the deficiency? Those who lent us in our distress have little encouragement to make advances again to our government. But give the power to Congress to lay such taxes that may be just and necessary, and public credit will revive. Yet because they had the power to lay taxes and excise, does it follow that they must? For my part, I hope it may not be necessary. But if it is, it is much easier for the citizens of the United States to contribute their proportion than for a few to bear the weight of the whole principal and interest of the domestic debt. And there is perfect security on this head, because the regulation must equally affect every state, and the law must originate with the immediate representatives of the people, subject to the investigation of the state representatives. But it is the abuse and argument against the use of power? I think it is not. And upon the whole, I think this power wisely and securely lodged in the hands of the general government, though on the first view of this work, I was of the opinion they might have done without it. But, sir, on reflection, I am satisfied that it is not only proper, but that our political salvation may depend upon the exercise of it.
That's a good argument, or somebody's actually laid out much better than what Wilson did in laying out why it's important. Because here he's saying, once they fail the requisition, then they can start exerting. Well, hold on here. If they send out the requisition at the end of the year, this is what we need you to pay us, then by that point in time, you failed. He's pointing out it's too late. It creates this completely downward spiral of failure. Anyway, the next objection, go ahead.
The next objection is against, quote, the power of raising and supporting armies and the appropriation of money for that use should not be for so long a term as 2 years, end quote. Is it not necessary that the authority superintending the general concern of the United States should have the power of raising and supporting armies? Are we, sir, to stand defenseless amidst conflicting nations? Wars are inevitable, but war cannot be declared without the consent of the immediate representatives of the people. They must also originate the law which appropriates the money for the support of the army, yet they can make no appropriation for a longer term than 2 years. But does it follow, because they may make appropriations for that period, that they must or even will do it? The power of raising and supporting armies is not only necessary, but is enjoyed by the present Congress, who also judge of the expediency or necessity of keeping them up. In England, there is a standing army, though in words it is engaged but for 1 year, yet is it not kept constantly up? Is there a year that Parliament refuses to grant them supplies? Though this is done annually, it might be done for any longer term. Are not their officers commissioned for life? And when they exercise this power with so much prudence, shall the representatives of this country be suspected the more because they are restricted to 2 years?
Right. So I think that the best description of standing armies and the nefariousness, or I should say what was the term that they used? It's in Virginia. The mischief. They used the term, the use of a standing army and the mischief that, you know, they're renowned for is really well laid out in Virginia. But here we go, because now we're talking about the militia now, because you can't talk about standing armies without the militia. Go ahead.
It is objected that the powers of Congress are too large because, quote, they have the power of calling forth the militia on necessary occasions and may call them from one end of the continent to the other and wantonly harass them. Besides, they may coerce men to act in the militia whose consciences are against bearing arms in any case, end quote. It is true, by this system, power is given to the Congress to organize, arm, and discipline the militia, but everything else is left to the state governments. They are to officer and train them. Congress have also the power of calling them forth for the purpose of executing the laws of the Union, suppressing insurrections, and repelling invasions. But can it be supposed they would call them in such case from Georgia to New Hampshire? Common sense must oppose the idea.
Okay. And that became one of the big deals. People did not want to see their loved ones or their families or themselves dragged away to outside of this, just the state. The idea of actually declaring war and having to go to a foreign land to fight that war could never have been in the interest of the United States. Because
I think one issue with that, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
But one issue, I can understand that, but at the same time, on the other side of it, having military experience, that would be the best way. Like, you don't want people from Pennsylvania, Western Pennsylvania, being called up in the militia to go suppress an insurrection in Western Pennsylvania. Because think about the implications of that.
Sure.
You know, if you had these people that were rebelling and they were insurrectionists, and you send their neighbors over there to quell the insurrection, then you might have them just turn around and join the insurrectionists because that's their neighbors and their brothers and their family and, you know what I mean, their community. So
Yes.
I actually think that's a good idea.
No, but having the militia doing it, because the militia now creates the attention of people that, because it's not, they're not, it's not a mercenary force. In other words, you're just sitting around anyway. If you look at the cavalry, when they created the cavalry to guard the expansion of the West, that became a permanent job and a permanent position. So when these guys, opened up Indiana, well, the next state was Illinois, and then the next state was the Dakotas and Minnesota, and so forth and so on. So you just kept on moving westward as the expanse went, and they just started filling more and more positions. They never relinquished their job. They never relinquished those positions, or at least it took a long time because it seemed like they were more interested in maintaining the forces than transferring the responsibility to the states to say, you need your militia to take care of this now. We've talked about this before. And so
I have a question on that.
Go
what
ahead.
About, they were talking about the frontiers and the Native Americans.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, it's just documented fact that the Native Americans would, harass and pillage and kill and violate the settlers out on the frontier.
Yeah.
And there's not enough people to call out the militia. And by the time you call out the militia, everybody's already been scalped.
Yeah, yeah. So that's when they're a territory, the cavalry goes out, and the cavalry basically secures the territory. So more and more people, because you can't keep, the government couldn't keep people from going out there and doing, trying, and saying, well, that's not going to happen to me. And then it happens to them. Well, that's, too bad. We couldn't get there, because you can't save everybody. You're absolutely right. But they do have, and they create this protection of getting the state ready to become a state. My point is, it should never become a state until it has sufficient people to guard it with its own force, because that's the whole point of the militia. Why is a state coming into the Union when it can't even provide its own militia for itself?
Now, well, how can they protect the United States territory before it becomes a state if they don't have a standing military force?
I'm not saying that they wouldn't have that. It's the perpetuation of maintaining the forts in Indiana, because at that point in time, they still may have had these Indians. They may have had, whatever the residual adjutants or, irritants or whatever.
Yeah, the Spanish or whoever. Yeah.
So, what have you. So the my point is that they have the responsibility of developing and securing the territories, but to continually leave forts in all of these states behind them, that was a disservice, and actually it was all unconstitutional. Those states should have actually taken over those responsibilities, period. That's my opinion, and that's the way I see it, because had they done that, then those states would have taken probably a little bit longer, and they probably would have been a little bit wiser. But it was to the federal government's position to quickly get these states into the Union so they could start taxing them. So, because they didn't mind, helping them out, but now they can pay their way and help and make them more dependent. So now that they have a harder time, I mean, that too is a catch-22. Anyway, folks, as always, I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.